I was asking John about discussion that had at the men's meeting this afternoon about sending some help to those that have been hit with the storm. And I want to share with you some information about this. And I have gone ahead and turned on the microphone so that this will be shared on our website also. Since Wednesday, I have been trying to get in contact with different areas, especially because some congregations in the Cookeville area are interested in sending some money directly to some churches in that area. And I was able, through a man that used to live on Long Island and was in the congregation of the last meeting that I had, to find out that the church where he attended on Long Island was not affected very much by the storm, and they didn't know of any of their families, at least, that were affected. And I've been trying to get in touch with someone on Staten Island since Wednesday, and so far have been unable to do that. I conducted a gospel meeting on Staten Island in 1988. The church at Henderson was supporting Bill Goldman, who was a preacher there. And then I went back and visited with them again since then. I don't remember exactly what year. So far, we've been unable to contact him or anyone on Staten Island. It appears that Staten Island is the worst hit of any of the places. Devastation is there. That's where the big ship was washed up on the shore. You may have seen that. And if I remember right, that's very close to where the church building is there, or maybe probably was there on Staten Island. But this afternoon, I talked with Joe Dudney, who is the director of disaster relief in Nashville, trying to get some information that I could get back to Cookeville. And he said that they had already made provisions to send food to five different areas where the storm hit. And I'm to call him back in the morning, and he's going to give me those areas and some of those contacts there so that I can help the people in Putnam County about this. But I want to tell you just a little bit about disaster relief. They have a large building in Nashville. It used to be an old Walmart or Lowe's. I guess it was Lowe's. And that's where the work is done to get the food ready. They have generators and chainsaws and things like that that they can send. When there is a disaster, they can load a truck in a matter of a few hours. They have an assembly line there where they use 60 people. And people from different congregations, even as far away as Springfield, come and man that assembly line. And they have boxes that go down that assembly line, and they put into each box the equivalent of groceries and related supplies that will take care of a family of four for 2 weeks. And they literally can run those boxes through and load a truck in a matter of a few hours. They normally will send a team of men into the storm area as soon as they can get there to search out the needs and to search out a congregation, if they can find one of the church, where they can take the food and let it be distributed by the local churches there. They tell me that the disaster relief program is able to make $1 cover $4. And the way they do that is they have some connections with different companies. I know at one time they were getting refrigerators from, I believe it was Westinghouse or Whirlpool, one of those. And they have places that they can get a lot of other things, some donated and some at a very minimal cost. And so for over the years, they have said that for each dollar that is sent to them, they are able to send $4 worth. And they have 18-wheelers. They load those trucks and then send them immediately. I'm somewhat familiar with what happened when Katrina hit in the New Orleans and Mobile area. And literally, there were church buildings down there that were just filled with food and other things, and they were able to put those out. And many, many people have been converted by getting their attention, letting them know that we help, and then following up with studies. And so whatever we decide to do, and I'm sure we'll do something, I think that this was discussed at the business meeting, whatever we decide to do, if we send $100, for example, for each $100 that we send to disaster relief in Nashville, then they will be able to send $400 into one of these areas to help. Joe Dudney, who is the director, is a distant cousin of mine. And Lynn Cook, who passed away earlier this year and was living in near Henderson, was one of their field representatives. And I've been associated with that work. I have visited the building. I've been there. I've seen what they do. And I just wanted to tell you that and share with you. You know, so many times we send money somewhere and we know that it's a good work, but we don't have information about it. And it's just helpful, I think, when we do have some connections. And whatever we send, I can assure you that this has been one of the greatest works that's been done. It's organized well. And I have no idea. It literally goes into the millions of dollars that go through that from churches and individuals to help take care of places where there's tornadoes and hurricanes and any time that there's a situation like that. But he said this afternoon that they were sending help to five different areas. I talked to him at home, and he didn't have the information. It's on his desk at work. And I'm calling him in the morning and get that information. And I will try to put some of that in the bulletin this coming week. I'm supposed to do the bulletin early and need a filler anyway. But anyway, I'll get some of that information, and then I will report to you later as I know. I hope we can find a contact on Staten Island because of the personal contact and having preached there and conducted a meeting there and supported a missionary there. If I remember right, the church is close to Front Street, and that's where the ship, that big ship, 100 and so many tons, was washed up on the shore. And they were still showing, I don't know whether you've seen any of the news today, but I watched it for a long time this afternoon. And there are a lot of people that have not gotten any help yet. And it's hard for me to sit here and really understand. One man they interviewed said that the whole neighborhood where he had lived was just wiped out completely. Of course, we've seen that happen in tornadoes, too. But I wanted to take a few minutes and give you a little bit of report on that. We are continuing our study tonight in the series of lessons that are related to Moses. Tonight, we're talking about the Decalogue. The word Decalogue is just another name for the Ten Commandments. Deca means ten. Log, in a sense, means a listing. It's a listing of the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue. I announced the subject for tonight to be the love that is found in the Decalogue. I expect to have at least one more lesson dealing with the Ten Commandments, and it may wind up with more than that. But tonight, let's think about three passages as we begin. In Matthew 22, at verse 36, Jesus is asked a question. Master, which is the great commandment in the law? Now remember, Jesus is under the law of Moses. The law of Moses is still in effect at this time. He said unto them, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind. And Luke's account adds, with all thy strength. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And we've talked about those two great commandments, love the Lord thy God and love thy neighbor. But look at the next verse. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Understand Jesus to be saying there that you can summarize all the law and all the prophets with these two commandments. The right kind of love for God and the right kind of love for one's neighbor. On this hangs all the law and the prophets. If you've never gotten this idea before, I want you to get it and put it in your mind. It is extremely helpful in studying the Old Testament. The Ten Commandments give us a skeleton outline of the entire law of Moses. The Ten Commandments are somewhat like a table of contents that some of you that are younger now and still in school may find in some of your books. You look at the table of contents in a history book or a literature book especially, and you'll find a rather lengthy listing sometimes, sometimes it's not that lengthy, of what is included in that book. And then the details that are given in the book come under one of those headings. I believe that you could put every one of the specific commandments that were given under the law of Moses under one of these 10 headings that are given in the 10 commandments. The Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, is an outline of the entire law of Moses, or a table of contents, in a sense, for the entire law of Moses. Now, with that in mind, think about what Jesus is saying. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. The law was the giving of the specific law, and you remember the Ten Commandments were written on tables of stone, written with the finger of God, Exodus 31:18 and Deuteronomy 9:10. You remember that those stones were broken the first time they were given when Moses came down from the mount and saw the idolatrous worship that had developed while he was up there. He went back and God wrote them again with his finger and gave him the two tables of stone on which were written the Ten Commandments. And those were kept in the tabernacle for a long period of time as a representative of the entire law of God. The Ten Commandments represented the entire law, and now Jesus says these two commandments represent the Ten Commandments, that you can hang everything that's said in them on these two commandments. There are two verses in Romans 13 that shed a little light on this. At verse 8 he says, "Owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law." He that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. Sometimes people will draw a contrast between law and grace, or law and love. And there is a type of contrast in that the New Testament emphasizes grace and maybe the Old Testament emphasized law. But folks, the Old Testament included the concept of love. The law, he says, hangs on love, because he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. And then in the 10th verse of that same chapter, Romans 13, "Love worketh no ill to his neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law." Love is the fulfilling of the law. Now, nobody could keep the law to perfection except Christ, which means nobody could love to perfection. Nobody could have the ability to love to perfection. But love is the fulfilling of the law. Now, having looked at those verses in the New Testament, let's go back to Exodus 20. Exodus 20 is where we have perhaps the first listing of the Ten Commandments, the giving of the Ten Commandments. Chapter says, beginning, "God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which hath brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." And then in verse 3, he gives the first of these Ten Commandments. And down through verse 17, gives us the Ten Commandments. "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," verse 3. "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image," verse 4. Verse 7, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain." Verse 8, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy." Verse 12, "Honor thy father and thy mother." Now you'll notice that there's additional information given, but these are the commandments. Verse 13, thou shalt not kill. 14, thou shalt not commit adultery. 15, thou shalt not steal. 16, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. And 17, thou shalt not covet. Those are the Ten Commandments. You've seen them listed many times. You probably are aware of controversy that is surrounding them even in our time. Just a few days ago, there was a trial having to do with whether or not they could be displayed in a certain courthouse, whether they could be displayed in public buildings. And the ACLU, perhaps with others involved, have been able to have a copy of the Ten Commandments removed from several places where they were at one time. Of course, you and I understand that the Ten Commandments were a part of the old law. We are not under those Ten Commandments today because of their being said in chapter 20 of the book of Exodus. We have 9 of them specifically mentioned in the new law, and the principle of the 10th one mentioned in the new law. But we are not under the Ten Commandments because they were given to the children of Israel. That entire law, including the ceremonial law and the written law in every aspect, was done away at the cross. Jesus nailed it to the cross and took it away, broke down that middle wall of partition between the Jews and the Gentiles. These Ten Commandments were given to the Jews, to the Israelites. God's law through Moses was given to the children of Israel. But those Ten Commandments are extremely important. We may change customs, we may change laws in the appropriate way, but principles never change. And the principle involved in every one of these commandments is exactly the same principle that you and I need to use today. The specific laws have changed. The specific ways that we go about carrying out some of these things may even change within our society, within our culture, and as customs come and go. But the idea is there. It might be possible to divide these Ten Commandments into 3 categories. The first 4 deal with man's relationship to God. The 5th one deals with the relationships in the family. And the last 5 deal with relationships with fellow man. I suppose you could divide them into 4 and 6, 4 having to do with the relationship with God and 6 having to do with the relationship with man. Tonight I want to divide them into 4 categories. The first 3 dealing with the specific love that man is to have for God. The 4th commandment, love that man is to have for worship. The 5th commandment, love that one is to have for his parents. And the last 5, love which respects other people and that which belongs to them. I think this is exactly what's included in these 10 commandments. Think about the first 3, for example. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. That has to do with one's love for God. When Jesus gave that first commandment with promise, he said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God, notice, with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. If one does that, he cannot have any other gods. That is dedicating one's complete self to God, recognizing that God is not only above everything, but that he is the only thing when it comes to the concept of God. He is the one who said, thou shalt have no other gods before me. You and I have no problem with that when we're thinking about gods, as we hear people talk about other types of gods. As we read Acts 17, for example, and see all the different gods that were mentioned and worshipped in one way or another at Mars Hill in Athens. But sometimes we may let other things become gods to us. Anything that we put above us and show respect to the detriment of failing to show respect to the real God, can become a God. We can let another person become a God. We can let something that we own become a God. If we have love for God that we ought to have, nothing else will ever take our respect and attention away from the God of heaven. We will put him first. We will love him in every situation. Related to that is the second commandment. Thou shalt not make unto me any graven image. When you and I read that, we think about the idols that existed during the time that this was written. There was Baal, Ashtaroth, and even others. There was what's called the groves, where they literally built images, and usually at the higher part of the hills, and would worship those instead of worshiping God. And many times, especially during the history that's recorded in Judges, there was the leaving the God of heaven and going after those graven gods that caused God to allow the children of Israel to be overcome. And it was only when they tore down those graven images, got rid of them, and turned back to the God of heaven, that he would raise up a judge to lead them out of the captivity. Thou shalt have no graven image. I'm rather sure that none of us tonight have a graven image at home or anywhere that we would bow down before and worship. I saw a program not too long ago about Buddhism, where there was the image of Buddha that people in this particular country kept in their homes, and they would go into that room and bow down before him. That would be bowing down before a graven image. I doubt that you and I would do that. But sometimes we may again, just as I said a moment ago, a person can become a god. We may again allow things in our lives to become a god. I think I have seen people become so attached to a house or an automobile they put them before the God of heaven. That's all they thought about. That was the one thing that they wanted. That's what consumed their time and their effort. And if we allow something in life, which is not wrong in and of itself, to become a graven image and we pay more respect to it than we do to God, we would be guilty of this same problem of having a graven image before God. And then he says, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. The idea of Jehovah means holy. You remember when we were studying the book of Revelation, even in heaven, there was the idea of holy, 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 paying respect to God and to his name. The name of God should never be taken in vain. And that means to take it and to use it in a lighter sense, not paying respect to it. The Bible teaches us that we should hold God, the name of God, in reverence and awe. The word awe, A-W-E, has come to be used in a very common way to talk about many things today, when in reality it is a word that probably should be kept to refer to God. Awe means that we recognize that something is so great that we cannot explain it. We stand in awe at it. And that's the attitude that we ought to have toward God. And if that's where we place him and that's where he is, there is never a time that it is right to use his name in vain. I think sometimes people do that without realizing what they are doing. I have mentioned to you before and use it again tonight to make this point. At least 90% of the people on game shows on television who win something, especially if it's a rather large winning, will almost without exception use three words. Oh my God. And I am convinced that MY before God is exactly the same as BY before God when used in a frivolous way. You probably have heard people curse use curse words. And many times, what is used is the two words by God. Now, those two words are fine if used in a sentence. I could say, for example, that the earth was created by God. That's simply using it in a positive statement. But to use those words in what we've called a cursing manner is to fail to pay respect to the name of God. And any way we would refer to God, and of course Christ would be on the same level in the area of respect, in a frivolous manner can certainly be a problem. Have you ever heard someone who was upset about something turn and say, "Well, Jesus Christ"? That's in a frivolous way. Now, saying the words Jesus Christ, there's nothing wrong with that. There are many appropriate ways to use them. But when we use that in vain, I do not want to hammer a point that maybe sometimes is hammered too much, but I think some of the bywords that we use may be an offshoot of the word God and the word Jesus. I'm rather sure that most people who use these do not think about it, but sometimes we may change a word just a little bit and use bywords in a way that does not show the kind of respect that we ought to have for God. The Bible says, "Let your yea be yea and your nay, nay." In other words, say what you mean and mean what you say. And usually a person who will use curse words or bywords or something in that way to emphasize what they're saying will indicate that they do not have confidence in what they are saying. We need to watch that. "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain." The name of God, the name of Christ, should never come off our lips in a light fashion, but with respect. Now Jesus says, love is the fulfilling of this, or the law and prophets hang on this. And Paul said, love is the fulfilling of this. "No other gods before me. Don't make any graven images. Don't take my name in vain." If we love and respect God like we should be able to carry that out. The fourth commandment has to do with worship. It is the one of the Ten Commandments that is not incorporated into the new law in a specific way, although the principle is. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. If you believe, want to know whether or not God intended for people to believe that and respect that, just study through the Old Testament. In chapter 31 of Exodus, for example, he gives a rather lengthy detail about how they are to respect that day. Remember on one occasion a man was stoned to death because he picked up sticks on the Sabbath day? Sort of like we were studying in Bible study this morning, God's rather specific about what he says. He told them to remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. In the New Testament, we have the first day of the week emphasized. Some have said that becomes our Sabbath. No, that wasn't intended to replace the Sabbath. It was intended to be that which was commanded to be a part of New Testament worship. But it does give us the principle of worship. If God expected all the Jewish people to remember the Sabbath day in the sense of worship, would you not conclude that he expects us to remember the Lord's day in a sense of worship? And if God punished them because there was no respect, could we not expect him to be displeased with us if we do not respect the Lord's day? The person who loved to worship God would have had no problem remembering the Sabbath day. And a person who really loves God and Christ today will have no trouble worshiping today. You know, we talk a lot about attending the services, whether or not we ought to attend every service. I think sometimes we're treating the symptoms instead of the disease. What we need to be talking about is whether or not we are in love with God and in love with Christ. My wife and I lived together 50 years. I do not ever remember one time that anybody had to beg me to go home when I had an opportunity to go home. That was never brought up. And those that knew me back several years ago knew that if I closed a meeting, sometimes 200 miles from home, at 8 o'clock at night, that I never went to bed. I went home. I never had to be begged to go home. And I cannot remember ever having had to be begged to go to worship services. There have been some that I could not attend. There have been times that I was hindered, more so during Judy's illness than any other time. During those 87 days, I was unable to go to church very much because of the requirements that were involved that I felt like God understood. But I've never been begged to go to services. But I've done a lot of begging and talking and pleading with people to try to get them to come to worship. I believe that one who is in love with God will want to be there to worship God when there is a reasonable opportunity. Now, there are times that it's not reasonable. There are times beyond our control. Today, we've had nurses, for example, and firemen and policemen that may have had to work shifts that were involved at all the services that were available. And by the way, I'm appreciative of the service that they have at South Jackson at 6 o'clock on Sunday morning that allows a way to take care of that with a lot of people. But folks, if we have to be begged and persuaded and pushed and pulled to go to worship God on this earth, there's something wrong with our love. And let me give you something to really think about. If a person had rather be somewhere else than with God's people worshiping when there's an opportunity today or any day, a reasonable opportunity, do you think he would enjoy heaven if he went there? Heaven's going to be a place of worship for an eternity. And I have a hard time believing that God's going to take somebody that really doesn't want to worship him here and force him into heaven and force him to worship him for an eternity. Now, if you want something to chew on and digest, think about that. An eternity is worshiping God, I started to say around the clock, but there is no clock, for an eternity. If we love God, we will enjoy worshiping him and being with his people. Then the fifth commandment has to do with love for parents. Honor thy father and thy mother. He used the word honor here and not the word obey. In Ephesians 6, both of them are used in the New Testament. The word honor includes the word obey. If a person honors his parents, he's going to obey those parents during the years at least that he is under their authority. If he honors his parents, he's going to do that with word of mouth, and he's going to do it with action. A part of that honor, for those of you that are younger, involves telling your parents how much you love them and appreciate them. And yes, it needs to come in the other direction too. It also involves showing honor to them in the way that you live. There is nothing that I could do in life that would bring honor to my parents any more than living a Christian life. There is nothing today that my four children can do to honor me any more than doing what is right according to the Word of God. When I hear of them doing things that are examples of New Testament Christians, I consider that an honor. I will admit that I wish they would say a few more things and send a few more texts and make a few more phone calls, don't you? But I suspect that my dad and mother felt the same way when they were living. And then there is the need of taking care of our parents when they get older. The Bible teaches that in 1 Timothy 5, and we need to honor our parents in that way. I recognized when my parents were getting older that there were some things that I could not do personally. And I disagreed with my sister when she told my mother, no matter what happens, I will never let you go to a nursing home. I think that was parallel to me saying to Mother, if you have an appendectomy, I'll never let them operate on you. I always felt that I would had the responsibility to do what I could and then see that the needs were met when it was something beyond what I could do. And I feel that way today in the responsibility of my children toward me. We are to love our parents and honor them. And they never get too old to where they don't deserve that honor. They may get ornery. I told my children not too long after Judy died, we were all together, I said, I want to tell you something now while I have at least reasonably good sense. If I get to the point that I can't take care of myself, I want you to find a nice place and I want you to put me there where my needs can be met. I said, now at that time, I'll argue with you. At that time, I'll tell you that that's not what you should do. But I'm telling you now, while I have good sense, that's what I want. And I believe that's what I should expect of my children, to see that my needs are met, taking care of me to the extent that they can, and then seeing that my needs are met. That's the attitude I had toward my parents. And I believe that involves the honor that he's talking about here. That's love. Love is not just saying, I love you. Love is shown by deeds. And then the last five really all have to do with respect for the person and the property of every person. Thou shalt not kill. To take one's life certainly is a serious thing. However, 1 John 3:15 says that he that hateth his brother is a murderer. We may kill in different ways. And anything that we might do to kill the reputation of another person, or to kill anything that has to do with him, or to show hatred toward him, would violate this principle. If we love people, we certainly are not going to be interested in taking their lives. Thou shalt not commit adultery. If we have the right kind of respect for all people, we will not want to violate the purity of their body or their life. Men are especially warned against that in Matthew 5:28. And in 1 Timothy 5, the first two or three verses, he says that a Christian, especially talking to younger men and women, ought to look at every older woman as their mother, every older man as their father, every younger man as their brother, and every younger woman as their sister. If we have the right relationship with people and we respect them, we respect their body, their mind, and their self, we will recognize that that's the kind of love that we ought to have. There is a kind of love that we're to have for everybody. There's a kind of brotherly love. There is a sense in which I love every one of you that's here tonight as a Christian. There's a sense in which I believe I can love each one of you ladies as a Christian. And yet that love involves respecting you for who you are and each relationship that you have in life. Thou shalt not commit adultery. There is the act of adultery, there is the state of adultery, and there is the thought of adultery. And there's even spiritual adultery that is discussed when, as Christians, we court the world instead of being faithful to the groom, Christ himself. Thou shalt not steal. I doubt that any of us tonight would leave here and go by somebody's house and take something. But there are other ways in which we can steal. If you cheat the IRS, is not that stealing? If you use principles that are not right in school and you cheat instead of doing your own work, is that not stealing from somebody else? And Malachi says that a man can rob God. God has given us, for example, the individual right to determine what we give of our means. But if we do not bring to him that which is right and we hold back, that is called stealing in the sight of God. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Putting that into a positive term is easily said by tell the truth. Tell the truth. Don't lie. I remember back through the years, the last several years especially, when polls have been taken, that the majority of American people think that there are times when it's all right to lie. And the majority of them say that everybody does it. But God says, tell the truth. Thou shalt not bear false witness. I remember when I was a boy that there was a lot of discussion about that man will tell you the truth. You can count on what he says. And I remember deals that were made in the community where I grew up without anything ever being put on paper. Each person was considered a man of his word. I'm not for sure that was wise not to put something on paper when a deal was made. But it happened because people trusted each other and knew that they would tell you the truth. The greatest compliment that I ever had made, in my opinion, was not intended necessarily for a compliment. But I was told, this happened in Cookeville, that two men were talking and were talking about me. And one of them said, I'll tell you, that Ben Flatt is too dumb to tell anything but the truth. Well, I consider that a compliment. We need to be sure we tell the truth. Now, sometimes we may, by human mistakes, not tell the truth as it is. But we need to live by the principle of being sure that we do not bear false witness. A false witness can tear down another person's reputation. And sometimes when it is torn down, it cannot be rebuilt. You and I have the idea before sometimes as we're talking and we'll say something and say, well, I take that back. You cannot really take back anything that you say. You can repent of it. You can make it as right as possible. You can apologize for it. But when you say something, you can't take that back. Sometimes in a trial, a witness will say something and the lawyer will object and the judge will look at the jury and say, disregard what the witness has said. I doubt that there's a person on that jury that can completely disregard what the witness has just said. So tell the truth. Back in the 1960s, I was at a hardware store in Carthage, and somebody made a statement that I've never forgotten. Don't remember who made the statement. Tell the truth, and you don't have to keep a record. Tell the truth, and you don't have to keep a record. If you change the truth, you'd better make you a note of how much you changed it. And remember that, ladies, when someone asks you your age. If you change it, you better make you a note of how much you changed it. Tell the truth, and you don't have to keep a record. And then, thou shalt not covet. I understand the word covet to mean to desire something that belongs to another to the detriment of that person. I don't think that means that it's wrong for us to desire something that another person has in the sense that we want something like that, or we would like to have that and that person have something that's better. But when we desire anything, and he even goes into detail here, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, his manservant, his maidservant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that is thy neighbor's. Covet is the idea of desiring something that belongs to another to his detriment, to his loss. And if we love other people, we're not going to want to do that. If I love you, I ought to be thankful that you have the things that you have. In honor, preferring one another, seek another man's wealth. And that doesn't mean seek it for yourself, but to seek it for him. Two statements made in the New Testament about this same idea. And so these last five commandments deal with the love that we're to have for one another. In the church, we call that brotherly love. And that's sort of the idea that was here. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. I've just touched the hem of the garment tonight on these Ten Commandments. I suspect we could talk about what's involved in them for a long time. But one thing is what we've tried to emphasize tonight, that every one of these commandments is really dealing with the subject of love. Love for God, love for worship, love for parents and the family, and love for one another in our human relationships that we have. He said, on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. I suppose that there is a sense in which, when we get to the day of judgment, that God could ask one question and deal with it all. If he asked us the question, how have you loved? Wouldn't that pretty well sum it up? Ask yourself that question. What kind of love do you have in your life toward God, toward worship, toward your family, and toward other people? And if you're the Christian that you ought to be, you'll have the kind of love that you ought to have. Oh, we're not perfect. It's not going to be perfect. But we'll be able to put together a life that is based on love, and that is the fulfilling of the commandments. If you're not a Christian, come as together we stand and sing.
Oh, think of the home over there by the sun.